Good morning, I'm William Seaman. Welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm here with Hala Gores. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning, Will, and to our listeners.
Yes, welcome to all of our listeners this morning. We'll be your hosts for this morning's program focused on Palestine-Israel, and we welcome your participation as well. If you'd like to call in with questions for our guests this morning, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That number is 503-231-8187. Now, we believe we are currently getting our first guest on the line, but later on this morning, we're going to be speaking with Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., longtime analyst and writer on Middle East and United Nations issues. Let's see, where are we in terms of our guest this morning? We are going to be actually going to our first guest. Phyllis Bennis is going to be our first guest this morning. So we'll keep you in suspense as to who we have lined up for the second part of the hour. Let me tell you a little bit about Phyllis Bennis. She is, as I mentioned, a fellow at both the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and at the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She's a writer, analyst, and activist on Middle East and UN issues, having worked as a journalist at the United Nations from the very early 90s. At the time just prior to the Gulf War. She's written on the ways the U.S. has dominated the United Nations, also on U.S. sanctions on Iraq prior to the most recent war and occupation. She's written on disarmament, and most recently, Ms. Bennis has written on the U.S. war and occupation in Iraq and in recent weeks on the threat of war on Iran. In 2001, she helped found and currently co-chairs the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. She works closely with United for Peace and Justice Coalition, and for the past 4 years has played an increasingly prominent role in the peace movement here in the United States. Ms. Bennis, thank you for joining us this morning.
Great to be with you.
Well, I'd like to start. The focus of our program, One Land, Many Voices, is on Palestine-Israel, and I'd like to start on the current crisis in Gaza, which seems only to worsen with each passing day. Back in July, Ms. Bennis, you described the increasing humanitarian crisis resulting from the Israeli blockade and military assault on Gaza. It's been over 4 months since that last piece that you published. There seems only to have been a worsening of the humanitarian situation there. How would you say the situation has changed in the last since last summer?
Well, you said it in the question. It's gotten much worse. This is one of the aftermaths of the summer's war that has gotten virtually no consistent attention in this country. There was a huge sigh of relief when the Israel-Lebanon ceasefire was signed, but in that period there was no attention being paid to the ongoing crisis in Gaza. As a result, the conditions that I wrote about back in July, I think I wrote about it after that, but the crisis that began really even before the escalating militarization of June and July, but began back in January following the Palestinian elections, which were held at the demand of the Bush administration, who were determined to show that their so-called democratization plan for the Middle East could apply in the Palestinian-occupied territories as well. And they insisted on the elections being held even before the Palestinians themselves said they were ready for them. Nonetheless, they went ahead, and by all accounts, including those of President Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center, as well as other international observers from the European Union and others, the elections were among the fairest ever held in the region. Now, I think there's some problems with that because, after all, they were held under conditions of military occupation. But nonetheless, it's clear that they did reflect a reasonably accurate assessment of where Palestinian public opinion was. And the result of the elections, of course, brought a Hamas-controlled government to power in the Palestinian territories. The factional fight between Hamas and the traditional leader, the secular Fatah organization, of Prime Minister Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas, has continued. But the most important component of what's led to this crisis has been the U.S.-Israeli orchestrated boycott of the Palestinian Authority and ultimately of all the Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza as a result of the Hamas leadership. The U.S. position is they will not talk to Hamas. They will not allow any country to provide economic aid. They will not push Israel to open the borders to allow the sale of Palestinian produce, for instance, or to allow goods to come in, to allow people to come or go, all of which is prohibited at this point. And as a result of that, of course, the economic conditions have spiraled completely out of control. The unemployment rates are hovering between 60% and 70% in Gaza. The levels of absolute poverty, people living on $2 a day or less, have dramatically increased, and there's no end in sight. The countries that have been willing to say they would provide some kind of financial aid to Palestinian hospitals, to Palestinian schools, the U.S. position has said that any country that does that will find its own banks prohibited from operating in the United States. So you have a scenario where, for example, some Arab countries have said that their national banks would serve as a transmittal mechanism to get cash to Palestinian institutions, hospitals, schools, whatever. The U.S. line is, no, hospitals are controlled by the Palestinian Health Ministry, which is, of course, led by the Hamas-dominated government. Schools are controlled by the Education Ministry, similarly controlled by Hamas. And therefore, any Arab bank that might allow money to be spent or to be, you know, to be transmitted through its arrangements to the Palestinians will find itself unable to function in the United States. So any bank that's faced with that choice, either do the right thing for humanitarian purposes or be allowed to make enormous profits in the United States, what do we think they're going to choose?
Good morning, Ms. Benes. This is Hala Goris.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. Can you explain why it is that the blockade is directly against Hamas and the Hamas victory when Fatah had decades of corruption, decades of violence against Israelis with more recently through the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and yet the administration, the U.S. administration, supports Fatah?
Yeah, the U.S. administration has made clear that they believe that they can make Fatah a pawn of their own in the power games in the region, that this is their weapon, if you will, against the rise of political Islamist organizations such as Hamas. The opposition from the U.S., the blockade and the embargo, is not officially based on anything that Hamas has actually done, as opposed to anything that Fatah has done. It's based on a demand for certain words officially. The U.S. position is that there are three criteria that Hamas must meet. They must agree to renounce violence, whatever that means, even though they had a 18-month-long ceasefire that they had not violated, although the Israelis had continued to violate it. It was a unilateral Hamas ceasefire. They must agree to recognize Israel without any explanation about which borders of Israel are they recognizing. Israel is, of course, the only state in the world that does not have declared borders. And they must agree to accept all earlier agreements that had been signed by earlier Palestinian governments without, again, defining which agreements. If we're talking, for example, of the so-called roadmap, which the Palestinian Authority under a Fatah-led government had agreed to, Israel had only agreed to it with 14 separate qualifications, as they put it, which were actually areas where they simply said they don't agree. and they're not accepting it. So it was never clarified what exactly are the Palestinians supposedly re-accepting. You know, this was one of these catch-22 situations where it was acknowledged pretty much unofficially that what was really going on was that this was an effort by the United States to punish the Palestinians, collective punishment specifically, something denied as legal by the Geneva Convention, something that Israel in particular bears a very particular responsibility because as the occupying power, it has obligations that, among other things, prohibit it from engaging in collective punishment. And nonetheless, this wasn't a move to collectively punish the entire population of the West Bank and Gaza, to punish them for having elected Hamas. And the goal was, very much like the imposition of sanctions, economic sanctions in Iraq after the first Gulf War, the goal there was to make life so miserable that people would turn on their government. I don't know who in Washington actually believes that that works. It has never worked. It always means that people turn against those imposing the sanctions or blockade on them. It happened in Iraq, and it's happened now again in Palestine. It shouldn't have surprised anyone.
It's a very interesting analysis. You know, the leader of the Palestinians for many years, Yasser Arafat, probably would not have stayed in power as long as he had, had the blockade against him not been imposed by Israel when they placed him in Ramallah. So it's, I think you're quite right that people tend to support those who are under attack by outsiders. You know, it's the continued assault on Gaza is something that has me perplexed. Some have said that the Israel is attempting to cover up its failure in Lebanon by focusing the Israeli public's and the world's public's attention away from what happened in that fiasco. Can you address that, please?
Well, I think that the attacks on Gaza go back to a period before the Lebanon War, and they're continuing after. I don't think the Lebanon War either caused or is the basis for the continuing attack on Gaza. I think it has a lot to do with maintaining the highly militarized nature of Israeli society. Israel is a country with a relatively small standing army and an enormous reserve army. Everybody in Israeli Jewish society, other than some strictly Orthodox Israelis, serve in the military, men and women, and all men remain in the reserves until they're 55. They serve usually two times a year, often for as much as 6 or 8 weeks each time. So the drain on the Israeli economy, not to mention the social consequences in terms of the rise of violence in the society, domestic violence, violence against children, violence among children, all of these are very much reflections of the kind of militarization of Israeli society that we see. But that can really only be maintained if there is this view that Israel remains under existential threat. Now, the reality is that the rockets that Palestinians have fired consistently from inside Gaza into Israeli cities, those attacks are indeed a violation of international law, which allows for the resistance against illegal occupation, but does not allow that resistance to take the form of attacking civilians, as these untargetable missiles and rockets are. Having said that, the notion that this is somehow posing an existential threat to Israel or to Israelis is simply nonsense. In the last 2 years of all of these rocket attacks, one person has been killed. So it's something that keeps the society very roiled up, but it is not by any stretch of the imagination the kind of existential threat that many Israeli politicians paint it as.
Well, you've mentioned the steps that the United States has taken to collectively punish the Palestinians for electing the Hamas government. But I wonder if you could comment on the character of that government, the character of the Hamas organization. You have written that there certainly appeared to be agreements indicating a path forward for a negotiated settlement involving the Hamas government. Could you describe what those opportunities are today and if there are any steps being taken from the Israeli standpoint or from the U.S. standpoint to come towards a negotiated settlement or a path towards a settlement with Hamas?
Well, in the first part of your question about what kind of a government it's been, it really hasn't been much of a government. It hasn't been able to govern. Among part of the Israeli tactics in this recent escalation since the election of Hamas has included the sweeps that have arrested eight members of the Hamas government and 20-some-odd members of Hamas members of the Palestinian parliament. Other members of the government are on the run because Israel has said they will capture and hold them indefinitely in Israeli prisons along with their colleagues. So, you know, whatever else they're doing, they're not governing. Half of them are on the run, half of them are in prison. It's a ridiculous notion to even think of them right now as a government. Now, there are efforts underway to move towards a new government of national unity. Independent members of the Palestinian parliament, led by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who's an independent parliamentarian, has been brokering talks between Fatah and Hamas, which would lead to the resignation of the Hamas Prime Minister, Ismail Haniyeh, and the appointment of a new government, a new cabinet, made up of technocrats who would be understood to be close to one or another of the two parties, either Hamas or Fatah, but not members of either one, and appointed primarily because of their technocratic skills in running the various ministries. Now, the problem is, while the Europeans have said that would be sufficient for them in terms of ending their participation in this U.S.-led blockade, the U.S. position is that's not good enough. We want a complete destruction of Hamas, essentially. We want them outlawed from participating in Palestinian governance. And as far as we know, the position of the Bush administration is that as long as there are any Hamas members anywhere near the government, they will continue to treat them as pariahs, to isolate them, impose the boycott, and not allow any other country to engage in normal relations with the Palestinians. So the question of whether this very hard-fought unity process, a very difficult process, because there are very different approaches between the two parties, but still there is some basis for possible unity, whether that's going to actually bring about an end to this crippling blockade remains very unclear. If it doesn't, it will all have been for naught. And the question of, there's a very legitimate question to be raised. The Palestinian population has spoken very clearly with a majority level of support for Hamas. Now, in my view, that was far more a vote against Fatah than it was a vote necessarily for the social program of Hamas. But nonetheless, it is what it is. For whatever reason, people did vote for Hamas. And so, essentially, not undermining, but changing the understanding of that vote by creating a government of national unity of technocrats is a violation of a sort of democracy. The Palestinians appear to be willing to accept that if it's going to lead to an end of the blockade. If it isn't, it's violating their own democratic processes for nothing.
And you're listening to One Land, Many Voices. Our guest this morning is Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, please give us a call at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. We'd love to hear from you, and I'm sure our guest would like to hear some questions from our listeners this morning. I'd like to follow up on this question of the Hamas government. Actually, what I was thinking of, for example, is this morning, a headline from the Associated Press, Hamas PM says factions agree on truce. There was an op-ed in the New York Times, I think a little at the beginning of this month, indicating What certainly sounded like overtures by the Hamas government explicitly aimed at, I think, overcoming the perception that is certainly widely held here in the United States that Hamas is calling for the destruction of Israel, that there's no one to negotiate with in Hamas. And these statements appear to indicate at least some potentials for negotiating along the lines that, at least as a part of U.S. stated policy, seem to be acceptable basis for negotiation. Is that something that you have seen in your work in terms of your understanding of the Hamas leadership?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think that there is a basis for a government of national unity. I think that, you know, Hamas, in a sense, came out of these elections stronger than they went in. people voted for them because they were fed up with FECA. They were fed up with the corruption, but they were also fed up with the failure. A number of Palestinians I spoke to on my last trip, which was just before the elections, said, you know, if we had one or the other, we probably would have still supported FECA. We could have dealt with the corruption, they said, if there was some level of success, if we thought there was some motion towards ending the occupation. We would have gone along with the kind of corruption that we've seen. On the other hand, they said, if it was a clean government, even if it was, you know, if there was no corruption, even if it was failing, we again still would have given them the benefit of the doubt and supported them. But the combination of failure and corruption had just become too much for a lot of Palestinians, and they voted for Hamas in rather extraordinary numbers, extraordinary enough that Hamas itself had not expected this kind of a win. They had said very clearly before the elections, we don't want the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We don't want the Defense Ministry. We don't want the Ministry of Finance. They said, we want what we know. We want social affairs. We want education. We want health care. That's what we know. That's what we want. As it turned out, they got them all, and they had to deal with it. So it's been a rough go for Hamas as well. They haven't had much of a chance to try to actually govern. So I think that the notion of a government of national unity is a very important development, not least because the level of sectarian fighting has really increased as well as the social conditions have deteriorated in the occupied territories. Food becomes scarce, jobs become even scarcer. All of that leads to social tensions, and some of that takes a very politically sectarian tone, and there have been fights. The various police agencies and militias have fought each other. So it's been a very, very socially damaging period in Palestinian society. So I think all of those things could be better addressed under the conditions of a government of national unity, but only if there is some recognition of that from the outside forces who have imposed this crippling blockade in the first place.
Ms. Bennis, we do have a caller on. Caller, good morning. Caller? And have we lost our caller? Good morning, caller.
I think we're going to have to wait for that caller to come through again. But let me remind our listeners, our other listeners, that if you'd like to join the conversation this morning, you can call 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Our guest this morning is Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also co-founder and, I believe, a co-director of U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation.
I'm actually not the co-chair any longer. I'm back on the steering committee, but I'm no longer the co-chair.
Back on the steering committee, then, of the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation. I know that this is a campaign that's been going for a number of years now. Have you seen, first of all, could you describe the work of the U.S. campaign and perhaps how you've seen that work evolve over the last several years?
Yeah, the campaign is actually a very exciting institution. It's a coalition of about, I think, about 220, 240 organizations, everything from tiny local organizations of 10 people who demonstrate outside their local federal building all the way to national church organizations of millions of people, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, and the Quakers and others, who are committed to changing U.S. policy. The focus is on the U.S., not on the twists and turns of what Israel does day to day, but what the U.S. does to enable the occupation to continue. So our goal is to end the occupation and build a policy of equal rights for all. That's the bottom line, and we rely on international law, the United Nations, and human rights as the basis for that. So we're consistent. We recognize violations of human rights by anybody, and we support an end to occupation and equal rights as the basis for a just and comprehensive peace throughout the region. But our target is United States policy, and in that context, we've actually seen a couple of small victories. They're very small, but in an era where it seemed like it was virtually impossible to get any progressive change in U.S. policy on the basis of pressure in this period in particular and in Congress, we've been able to do that. Our grassroots advocacy work, our educational work in Congress has led to a congressional district coordinator network of I think we have people in about 225 or so congressional districts who talk every month about what the issue is for that month. And, for example, we were able to get removed from a bill in Congress about 6 or 8 months ago a reference that had been inserted in the bill. No one in Congress seemed to even know who had put it in, but it was a very terrible escalation in the U.S. effort to isolate the Palestinians. It called for closing down the Palestinian Information Office in Washington, denying U.S. visas to anyone, any Palestinian who had any connection to the Palestinian Authority, whether they were from Hamas or not. It was a draconian component of this bill, and it was going on a stealthy basis. No one even knew about it. Members of Congress didn't even know about it. And when we realized what was going on, a number of our members began education campaigns with their members of Congress that led to that section of the bill being deleted. So that was the first time that we were able to claim a precise victory.
Ms.
Some of the work
Ms.
in the Caterpillar campaign, for example, that has targeted the Caterpillar company, whose armored bulldozers, a particular kind of bulldozer they make called the D9 bulldozer, are sent to the Israeli military to be armored and then used as weapons of war. They're used to demolish houses. They're used to dig up olive trees. It was a D9 bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier in Rafah in March of 2003 that killed the young Rachel Corrie, a young peace activist from the United States who was trying to prevent the demolition of the house of a physician in Rafah. So
Ms. Dennis,
campaign.
If I may interrupt, we do have a couple of callers. If we can take the first caller now.
Sure.
Good morning, caller.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
This is Laurie Knightley, and I've been interested in the Palestine cause for, well, generations in my family. And I wanted to ask, maybe Hala could comment on this, if Hamas might recognize Israel de facto, not de jure, so that eventually they could bring it before a legal forum. Palestine's been denied access to due process since 47, when the General Assembly denied letting them go to the World Court, because we can talk about the picture of war, but getting at a real geopolitical analysis in a legal sense we have not done, and where there's these vague boundaries and whatnot, if eventually they could go to court and have it reviewed, it seems to me it would make a big difference. And I wondered if the de facto concept has been suggested.
Okay. I think I'd like to pass that on to Phyllis, because I think she is the expert.
Okay.
Thank you.
It is an important idea, and it's already underway. There were a number, I don't know if you've seen them, but there were a number of op-ed pieces that were written by Hamas leaders in the first couple of months after the election in January, one was in the New York Times, one was in the Washington Post. They were very, very interesting, because they put out a very clear understanding that certainly it debunked this mythology that all they stand for is the destruction of the State of Israel.
Yeah,
they
did,
de facto. These were the Hamas leaders.
But was the excuse that we couldn't do business, and now it's Hamas, we can't
do
business.
Right, it's an excuse, as you say.
Yes.
But the point is, there have been legal campaigns that that have won in the World Court. For example, the
wall.
Campaign Against the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very important decision in July of 2004, where the World Court held that the wall itself and the settlement process of which it was a part was completely illegal everywhere that it was inside Palestinian territory. The issue is not so much for the Palestinians to bring more cases, although that's always useful, but it's a question of what do we do here and what does the international community do to enforce those existing positions. So I think the work, for example, there's a coalition based at the United Nations called the International Coordinating Network on Palestine, which is working specifically on these issues of enforcement of existing international law, becomes a very important component. And to the degree that our work in the U.S. targets the position that our government takes in the U.N. preventing the implementation of these resolutions and these decisions of the World Court, that becomes a very important component of our work.
Good. So.
Caller, do you have another question for our guest?
Yeah, that's good to hear that there has, because not having access to due process to me and still talk about ethics is just ludicrous, and they have had no access really, except this thing on the wall, which was late in the picture, to actually review. You could not only review law, but you could review even the religion, because the Messiah has not returned, according to the religious access and justification, and then look at the legal aspects and the whole picture, and you come out with a very dismal situation. But thank you.
Thank you, caller. And we do have another caller on the line. Caller, would you like to pose your question?
Well, good morning. How are you? Okay, first of all, I really want to thank you for opening up this dialogue. This has been a very, very long time coming. As Americans, we get such a lopsided view of what's going on there because the United States is so pro-Israel that we are not getting a fair and balanced part of the story. This is not good for us because we have no information to base any kind of judgment or decision on about this, is because it's so obviously one-sided. And where do we go for a fair and balanced view of what's going on there?
Well, the question that you raise is a very crucial one, and it has everything to do with education.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in my view, the work of the U.S. campaign and all of our constituent organizations, at the end of the day, whether it's people that are organizing letter-writing campaigns, whether it's people doing media watchdog work, whether it's people working in Congress, whether it's people organizing demonstrations, all of it is about education. And we're up against a huge challenge. The pro-Israeli lobbies in this country, both the traditional lobbies and the newer Christian fundamentalist lobbies, the education system, all of them are very much shaped by a set of pro-Israeli assumptions. And we have a huge job to do to challenge what's wrong about those assumptions. Not every single bit of it is wrong, of course, but huge chunks of it is wrong. So it's really all about education. So one of the things we've tried to do, for example, in the U.S. campaign is produce resources that can be used by everybody, that are very basic, that don't require a lot of, you know, background information. One-page fact sheets, for instance. If you go to the campaign website, which is endtheoccupation.org, on the resources page, there's lists of fact sheets on every issue you could imagine. There's basic materials on the Caterpillar campaign, and how to do media work, in the congressional advocacy training, all of these things. And that becomes very important. I'm just finishing a new book that's going to come out as a small primer that can be sold at bookstores near the cash register, you know, one of those little ones,
mm-hmm.
that's called Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a set of frequently asked questions. Who are the Palestinians? Why are the Palestinians in Israel? Who are the Israelis? What are the settlers? What is the apartheid wall? All of these basic questions. We're at, in a sense, ironically enough, we're at a very lucky moment, I think, right now, because the publication last week of President Jimmy Carter's new book, which is called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, is raising huge controversies because of the title and because he makes the analogy of Israeli policies with the policies of apartheid. I think this is a huge opportunity for all of us to seize that moment.
Good.
To start talking about why the term apartheid does apply. Not because Israel is identical to South Africa. There's all kinds of differences. But, among other things, we have to remember that the United Nations, back in 1973,
right.
passed a resolution calling for an international convention against what the UN called the international crime of apartheid. And they made very clear that apartheid is not simply what South Africa did. It's a set of policies based on discrimination and separating peoples. And that's what we're seeing both inside Israel and in the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the publication of President Carter's book gives us a huge opportunity to start talking about that. We shouldn't shy away from it. We should embrace it. Write letters to the editor saying, this is great that President Carter has written this book, because finally we can start talking about what are the essence of these policies? And if this isn't apartheid, what is it? You know, and really engage with that.
I want to remind, caller, I just want to remind our listeners that you're tuned in to One Land, Many Voices, and you're tuned in to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, and in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, and in the Columbia Gorge at 91.9 FM. Also available as streaming audio at our website at kboo.org. Our guest this morning is Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. And caller, did you have another question?
Just a couple more quick things. I don't want to tie up your time.
I want to find out from our guest, though, Ms. Bennis. Can we impose on you to stay online for a little bit
longer? I've got about 10 more minutes.
Ten more minutes. It is. Thank you.
Okay. I'll be up very, very quickly. Okay. The United States gives Israel $3 billion a year in military aid.
It's less than half of that is economic aid. A little more than half is military aid. Yeah.
I understand that Israel has also has allegedly 300 nuclear warheads in their arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
If that's correct. Israel also has more F-16 fighter planes than anybody else in the area. So why is the government, if the government of the United States wants to have a quest for peace, then maybe you can explain to me why Israel is so heavily armed.
Well, maybe you can explain it based on your question. you answer your question with the question.
Okay.
The U.S., in my view, is not committed to a just and lasting peace in the region. It's not committed to a comprehensive peace based on international law. It's committed to a notion of peace which is basically an enforced stability based on continuing the asymmetry of power between Israel and its neighbors, particularly between Israel and the Palestinians. And it's that asymmetry of power that remains so destabilizing, not only in terms of the relationship between Israel and Palestine, but if you look at the quest for nuclear weapons in the region, it has everything to do with the fact that Israel has them and no one else does.
Mm-hmm.
Israel doesn't acknowledge their nuclear arsenal. It was 20 years ago that a nuclear whistleblower went public.
Yeah, Mordechai Vanunu.
Sorry?
Mordechai Vanunu.
Mordechai Vanunu, exactly, who went public and was then, of course, kidnapped and held in solitary confinement for almost 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And just released a little over a year ago under very, very severe restrictions. He's not allowed to talk to the international press. He's not allowed to leave his compound, etc. But it's widely known around the world that Israel does have somewhere between 200 and 400 high-density nuclear warheads in its Dimona plant in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that scenario exists, other countries in the region are going to want one, too. It's the ultimate nightmare of proliferation.
Of course,
the real question is for not only the U.S., but all of the nuclear powers, the official ones, the five, and the unofficial ones, India, Pakistan, and Israel, if they're serious about non-proliferation for other countries, they have to be serious about their own obligations under the non-proliferation treaty for disarmament. You can't have one without the other.
Thank you.
And that's the real challenge that we face, certainly in the Middle East, where Egypt and other countries have proposed a nuclear weapons-free zone throughout the Middle East. And we should note that, in fact, the United States, although they never admit it, the United States is itself on record supporting not only a nuclear weapons-free zone, but a weapons-of-mass-destruction-free zone throughout the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the language they drafted
mm-hmm.
of the resolution ending the war in Iraq in 1991.
I knew that.
And they just did it, assuming that nobody would pay attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're on record saying that all of this work of disarming Iraq should be part of our broader goal of establishing in the Middle East a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction and the missiles to deliver them. Period, full stop. No exception for Israel.
Oh, thank you, caller.
Thank you very, very much. And again, thank you so much for this dialogue.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bennis, you're lighting up our phone lines. We do have another caller. Go ahead, caller.
Is that me?
Yes, it's you.
Thank you very much. The one thing that seems to me to throw everything into contention always seems every time there's advance in talks, in peace in any way, there's another incident of terrorism that just throws everybody, just makes everybody crazy. And what I'm concerned with in particular is if there isn't a strategy of tension being pursued as it was in Italy, as we now know that Al-Qaeda, for example, is an operative in a strategy of tension in the war of terror. And my question to you, do you have any evidence, for example, that Mossad could be involved in false flag terrorism within Israel itself in order to promote a strategy of tension to defeat any efforts toward peace?
Well, I don't think that the Mossad needs to do that. I think the reality is that the kind of lack of hope, the kind of pressure created by the closing off of the Palestinian territories, not only from Israel, but from each other, you know, the division within the West Bank, for instance, through settler-only roads, settler-only bridges, the settlements themselves, as well as the apartheid wall that divides cities, that divides villages from each other, that divides villages from the city where they get education and health services, squeezing Palestinians into smaller and smaller and smaller Bantustan-like cantons, this is enough to create enough pressure and enough tension that it does explode. Young people, primarily, although we now have seen a grandmother, but primarily young people who are desperate, who see no way out, who see nothing to live for, will choose the horrific route of suicide bombing to at least, in their view, make it worth something when they die. It's the result of hopelessness, and it's a devastating reality. I've, you know, there's conspiracy theories abound, but I've never seen any evidence that the Mossad needs to do that. Certainly the Mossad makes the most of it, and they, as I mentioned earlier, the notion of maintaining Israel as as if it were a state that was threatened existentially aids the Israeli government and certainly the Israeli military, but I've never seen evidence that they've had to concoct those attacks. I should point out that not every suicide bombing is itself a violation of international law or terrorism. Terrorism is defined first and foremost by the notion that it's attacking civilians who are noncombatants. Now, many of the suicide bombings have been just that, and those are, in my view, terrorist attacks that are a violation of international law. We may understand why they happen as a part of trying to prevent them, but they are no doubt violations. However, some of the suicide bombings have actually targeted military targets in the occupied territories or on the border in a checkpoint, that sort of thing. Those are not either violations of international law or acts of terrorism. Those are acts, horrific as they may be, of legitimate resistance against an occupying authority. So we need to be very careful in distinguishing how we come to understand both what gives rise to suicide bombings and what the consequences of them are.
Ms. Bennis, do you have time for one more caller?
One more call.
Okay, thank you. Caller?
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Oh, hi, thank you. Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for your work on bringing justice and peace to the Middle East. I have a question, I'd welcome your comments. What I believe to be a significant event happened during an Arab League meeting in Beirut, I believe in March 2002, mm-hmm. where the Arab League unanimously, all 22 countries, including the Palestinians, passed a resolution calling for normalization of relations with Israel if Israel would agree to, agreement on the International Security Council, you know, resolutions calling for a withdrawal to the 67, you know, borders or thereabouts. And I don't know if it's ever been called, you know, anything at the international level has called for a two-state solution, but I believe there has been efforts in that area. But can you comment about the significance of that resolution and why it's not being promoted very much?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Arab League Summit did call for exactly that, for full normalization of relations, which was something very important. It was the first time that the Arab states had offered not just a ceasefire, but actual normalization, implying trade relations, tourism, all those things, open borders with Israel. based on Israel's withdrawal to the 67 borders. Israel basically said, forget it, we never intended to withdraw to the 67 borders. We don't intend to now, so let's move on. That's not the basis of an agreement. Less surprising, but more unfortunate, perhaps, was the U.S. position, which essentially said the same thing. The Europeans at various points have held that up. Tony Blair, I think quite hypocritically, but nonetheless, has held it up as a model of what could lead to not only a possibility for peace between Israel and Palestine, but the basis for a more stable arrangement of countries in the region as a whole, where the issue of the Israeli occupation continues to feed the instability inside Iraq, in all the surrounding Arab countries, in Syria, where Israel, of course, still occupies the Golan Heights, all of that. So I think that there was a huge potential in the Arab League declaration. There's some thought that if there were to be a new national unity government in the Palestinian territories, that they might accept the Arab League summit as a way of doing what an earlier caller suggested of a de facto recognition of Israel without saying the words, but accepting the Arab League declaration as the basis on which they would move forward in relations with Israel, which implies recognition without using the words. So it's potentially a very important move, but it only can go forward if the Israelis accept it as legitimate, which so far they have not.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you, caller. I want to thank our guest, Phyllis Bennis, for being very generous with her time this morning. I also want to give you an opportunity, Ms. Bennis, if you'd like to close with any remarks or any particular issues you think our listeners should be thinking about around this issue.
Well, I would just urge people to remember that this coming June of 2007, will mark 40 years of occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. There has been a call issued globally for a global day of protest. The world says no to Israeli occupation. On that day, there will be, a major mobilization probably in Washington, but also local and regional protests as well, to say 40 years is way too long. It's time we end the occupation. I would urge people to get their own organizations involved with the work of the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. You can get that information I was talking about earlier from the U.S. campaign website, endtheoccupation.org, or there's also information at my website for the Institute for Policy Studies, which is ips-dc.org. But the key thing is education. That's the obligation we all have to ourselves and to our children.
And when is this new book of yours coming out, this primer on Palestine?
It's supposed to go to the printer next week, so it should be out within about a month or so. It'll be available from Interlink Publishing. That's interlinkbooks.com, but also the U.S. campaign will have copies, lots of different peace and justice organizations. And I just one last note for those, and I know there's a very active peace movement in the Portland area and throughout Oregon and Eugene and elsewhere, certainly in throughout Oregon, where people remember Rachel Corrie very powerfully. There is a really important need to link the question of ending the occupation of Iraq and ending the occupation of Palestine. It's wrong in Iraq, it's wrong in Palestine, and we need to make that connection and build the links between those movements.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and especially thank you for being generous with your time and speaking with us for so long this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And for our readers, we're going to go ahead, or listeners, sorry, we're going to go ahead and keep those lines open. Our next interviewee is from Gaza, Dr. Ghazi Hamad, and we have been unable to reach him this morning. We don't know if that's a function of the lines being down over there, or I know when I spoke with him last night, he was very busy with interviews on Al Jazeera and CNN and other news agencies on the issue of the unity government. So we're going to continue to have the lines open, and hopefully we can have Dr. Hamad on the next show.
And we do, of course, want to hear from you. We'd like to get your thoughts about the types of guests you'd like to hear on future editions of One Land, Many Voices. I'd like to mention a couple of events that are coming up somewhat related to the topics we've been discussing this morning. There is going to be a film showing at the Hollywood Theater December 1st through the 7th of a film called Encounterpoint. And Encounterpoint is an 85-minute feature documentary that follows a former Israeli settler, a Palestinian ex-prisoner, and a bereaved Israeli mother, and a wounded Palestinian bereaved brother who risked their lives and public standing to promote a nonviolent end to the conflict. That's a film showing at Hollywood Theater December 1st through the 7th. I'd also like to mention that there is a very special city council meeting this Thursday, November 30th at 2 p.m. The city council here in Portland is going to be considering a resolution for the U.S. military to withdraw from Iraq. That's this Thursday, November 30th at 2 p.m. So there's a couple of events definitely worth thinking about, definitely worth perhaps participating in. We have a caller on the line now. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, caller.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Well, okay. I guess, you know, I always get really frustrated when I hear talk about Israel and Palestine on the radio, and there just seems to be a lot of stuff that people just don't quite understand, some of the fundamental stuff. And, you know, I feel as though, like, your guest just, you know, ignores a lot of stuff that really should be well known, you know. And, you know, what we're talking about here with Israel is, you know, a very religious state. You know, these are people that are believe this is their homeland, and it's an example of late European colonialism. And we just gave the European powers just gave them that land. They had no right to give them that land. And they treat the people that live there, the Palestinians, as if they weren't there. Now, this whole question of the recognition of this state, this illegal state that's never declared its borders, it's a very special case. There's no other state in the world that we talk about in these very strange terms. Nobody has to recognize the existence of any state. They just are. They have their own validity. This particular state, Israel, that the Zionists were able to get the European powers out of shame of what the Nazis did to give them this land, is not really a legitimate state. And to talk as though this incredibly heavily armed state, you know, another caller talked about that they had more F-16s in the surrounding region. The real point of that is that they're the only people there that could actually use that particular weapon of war, because we allow them to. I think it needs to be understood that ever since the 67 war, when the United States started to support these Zionists, and I say that because I don't believe that Jewish people like to be identified necessarily with Israel, because it's, you know, run by these Zionists, which are, you know, a certain faction of the Jewish religion. They wanted to go back to the homeland.
And caller, not only that, but you have Christian Zionists who are becoming extremely powerful. You know, now not only are we having to contend with what AIPAC is doing in Washington, D.C. and all over these states, but also with the Christian Zionists and their powerful lobby.
Absolutely, and some of the very worst extreme Jews that go there and extreme Christians with violent tendencies come from the United States because of the nature of our fundamentalist society. But, you know, it needs to be understood that we don't need to recognize the existence. The Palestinians don't need to recognize the existence of this state. The Zionists believe that they can take all the land south of the Litani River in southern Lebanon, for instance. It needs to be understood that the Palestinians, the Arabs have offered full peace many times. You know, the Camp David Accord in 77 was simply to get Egypt out of the way so that Israel could attack Lebanon. Now, you know, the idea that these rockets somehow are a weapon compared to the high-tech weaponry that the Zionists use, our high-tech weaponry. And I want to make it clear that they're there as a policeman on the beat. This is Henry Kissinger's quote, and that's the function of them, to be our policemen on the beat in that incredibly oil-rich region. We want to keep it unstable. They are a completely dependent client state on the United States. They cannot do anything without our say-so. When I talk about a dependent client state, we didn't talk about the satellite countries of the Soviet Union as having an independent foreign policy. because they would consider them client-dependent states. I think we need to understand that Israel is actually a completely dependent client state on our government.
Hey, caller, let me pose this question to you.
We have one. I wonder if we have one more caller on, and I wonder if we can try to get them. And we have barely 3 minutes.
Sure, I know we're running out of time. It's just again, it frustrates me that many of these issues just aren't raised, because to me, these are the most fundamental issues.
We share your frustration, and we hope we can let this caller raise another issue. And you, please call in on our next show, which will be in December. Next caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to ask the aspect can suggest somebody to come interview on the show. One person that's really a good candidate is Raed, who's an Iraqi blogger, and his blog is called Raed in the Middle, and he's a very good candidate for talk and support to the end of the occupation in Iraq, and he's a very active in the society here, and it's what's going on actually here in the U.S. So this one good candidate I wanted to suggest, and that's it.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You for
that's a wonderful suggestion. Our listeners here at KABU, of course, who tune into Democracy Now! Have heard that excellent blogger from Iraq, and we hope to have many other guests. We're coming up to the end of our hour here. We do want to invite you to tune in. We don't have a date yet for our next show, do we, Hala?
Not yet.
But we are hoping to settle into a regular time slot here. The program is One Land, Many Voices. Your hosts are, I am William Seaman, and my co-host,
Hala Goris.
And we hope to engage you not only in hearing different voices on this urgent issue of our time, the Palestine-Israel conflict, the striving for, the search for a path to peace and a path to justice in that troubled region. We hope to engage you not only in terms of listening, but also in terms of calling in and joining the conversation and joining the discussion. So with that, we would like to thank you for tuning in, and invite you to tune in again next time for One Land, Many Voices.
Thank you.